From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I confess to something of a weakness for Japanese maples, and I suspect I'm not alone. And now, thanks to breeding work by experts like today's guests, there are more and more varieties being made available that are suited to a widening range of climate zones and garden conditions, meaning the circle of maple lovers can keep on growing. More in a moment about these choicest of small garden trees with the founders of Mr. Maple Nursery, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Brothers Matt and Tim Nichols are the forces behind MrMaple.com, a North Carolina-based retail mail-order nursery with a staggering collection of about 1,500 different Japanese maple varieties to offer. They ship 100 trees a day year-round, as many as 700 plus a day in peak season, and as if that were not enough, last fall the Nichols brothers acquired an esteemed wholesale nursery in Oregon, Buchholz & Buchholz, so now they're selling to garden centers too. I'm so glad to welcome them to the program today to talk about these irresistibly collectible trees. Hi, Tim. Hi, Matt. How are you?
Hey, thanks so much for having us. Man, if I ever am having a bad day, I'm going to go back and listen to that. I feel pretty cool.
Margaret, thanks so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast.
Oh, well, and we just did a New York Times garden column together. After I learned about your expansion and purchase of Buchholz & Buchholz. But I was first introduced to you years ago by our mutual friend, Tony Avon of Plant Delights Nursery, who's a big fan of yours. So I think we should do a shout out to Tony to thank him for introducing us originally.
Oh, big shout out to Tony. He's a huge mentor of ours and just a huge influence on us.
Yeah. He has really took us under his wing when we were very small and really helped us on the business side of things. It was always fun because we would go to his nursery, talk about plants at Plant Delights Nursery. And then we'd go out to dinner and we'd do nothing but talk business. And so it's always been a fun friendship and mentorship with Tony Avent for sure.
Yeah, he's taught me a lot too. And he continues to always have great suggestions, introduce me to people. I mean, I'm just completely grateful. So shout out, Tony. So maples, the sort of origin story of what's now Mr. Maple is kind of a fun one. And you grew up with maples being sort of a thing on both sides of your family. And your father had a hobby business with Japanese maples. And, you know, it was like you were destined to become a pair of Mr. Maples, huh? You know, tell us a sort of the brief version of that.
So our grandmother started growing Japanese maples in the 1950s. She was sort of one of the people who a pioneer who grew Japanese maples, never meant to sell them. And then people come and started asking her, hey, can I buy these? Because she had them lined out in rows and they started getting tighter. And she said, sure. And she tagged everyone in between and started selling Japanese maples in the 1950s. My dad officially started Nichols Nursery from the other side of the family about 50 years ago. And that was what morphed into Mr. Maple today. And so we actually got it from both sides of our family, our mother's side with our grandmother growing Japanese maples and our dad's side who started growing Japanese maples before you ever met my mother.
That's crazy, kind of, isn't it?
It's wild. We've kind of done this our whole lives. Tim and I grew up, you know, going to flea markets. They weren't even called tailgate markets back then or farmers markets. That hadn't really hit the South yet. We just called them flea markets. So we would go to high-end flea markets and sell Japanese maples, bald and burlap and things like that growing up. And it's just something we always did. If you'd asked me when I was 12, if I'd be doing this for a living, I'd have laughed at you because this was my busy work with dad, you know, getting out and potting up all the rootstock. And our father taught himself to graft and just kind of became a little bit of an aficionado for maples for himself, just as a hobby. He worked at a factory and this was his way to get out and forget about, you know, the day-to-day work and enjoy himself. And around 2008, Tim and I started taking it a little bit more seriously, and Dad said, well, you guys are going to take all the fun out of it and make it work. So I guess we made it more of a career rather than a fun hobby that we were pursuing.
The crazy thing is, you know, now Mr. Maple has really been blessed, and we've really grew so much that now, you know, we recently purchased Buckholtz Nursery, who, you know, he purchased the grounds from J.D. Veritree's family, who J.D. Veritree's wrote the book on Japanese maples. And so here we are from this, you know, real small family nursery to now, you know, purchasing this historic nursery at Buckholtz Nursery. And it seems like everything's just came full circle.
Yeah, no legacy. It's great. The hand-me-down. And I love that about gardening in general, is that the provenance of things and the pass along and the, you know, it's just the generations. So let's talk about the plants. You know, there's such an incredible diversity of tree shapes and habits, you know, of the trees, the sizes of trees, in Japanese maples, leaf color, oh my goodness, texture, scale of leaves, and on and on and on, you know, to choose from. So when we did the Times column, you told me that, however, you know, despite all that potential diversity, there's sort of like two archetypal versions that gardeners mostly buy, you know, and what are those?
So people typically get introduced to Japanese maples through a lace leaf, like a red lace leaf, you know, weeping form, or red upright. That's typically the gateway entry into Japanese maple collecting. And they, you know, they get a red upright, and then they start to explore all the many differences and nuances, and they've got to have more.
Right.
And that's one of the things about Japanese maples. They're kind of like potato chips. You can't have just one. And whenever you get one, you get addicted to how beautiful they are. And you start thinking, I've got all these other spaces in my garden. What else can I put in these spaces? When they realize there's so much diversity in Japanese maples. There's a Japanese maple for nearly every spot in the garden.
And just, I mean, some of them, like as you were saying, are weeping. Some are upright. There are different sizes, the colors of the foliage, I mean, gold and green and, you know, kind of dark red colors and pinkish colors. And I mean, variegated and splashed and splotched and edged. And, you know, there's a lot of colors, and the fall color that you can get out of them is like astonishing.
I understand it can be quite overwhelming for people getting into Japanese maples. There's so much diversity going on there and so many interesting things. You know, we try to make it easy sometimes by curating a collection a little bit of different types. So maybe we'll list something that has one specific variegated pink and white type with a couple yellows and a few cool dwarfs. So we'll pick a few things from each category and kind of curate it a little bit, because it can be a little overwhelming to get into a hobby and know there's 1,500 different varieties of this one thing. And some people are completionists, so they try to get all of them. So that can be quite frustrating too, I'm sure. But there's so many interesting nuances to them, from the color to the leaf shape to the texture to the fall colors. You really can continue to just explore and find new ways to kind of match them. Now, we tend to mass garden with Japanese maples, so we'll end up planting things near each other that are both maples, but we'll use diversity of color, height, and then fall color. That way they change a little bit each season. So, you know, maybe that yellow and that red are going to play off each other during one season, but then that orange, you know, and then a deeper red or a more crimson fall color will play off each other during a different season.
Yeah. Before I talked to you guys for the New York Times article, I didn't even know, for instance, although I guess in my head, if you had asked me, I would have said, yeah, that sounds right. I didn't even know until you told me that lace leaf types are usually weeping forms, you know, that's like but there are exceptions, right? But that's a typical combination, lace leaf and weepers.
Yeah, that's so true. And, you know, there are lace leaf and weepers are typically just that cascading umbrella habit that you get out in, you know, the landscape. And that's what a lot of people start out with. There are exceptions, though, that have that palmore palmate leaf and weeping habit. And then there are some exceptions that have more an upright habit, like Seiryu, very, very popular tree that's very vigorous and upright. But, you know, that's pretty rare, is getting a lace leaf upright. That's something that you don't see too frequently. Its main thing with people whenever they're starting out with the Japanese maple, one thing I just want to get out to everybody is figure out the tree for the right spot in the garden.
Yeah.
With so much diversity, go and look and see what size you have. Think about your 10-year expectancy of height and width, and then find a tree that fits that space, because there's so many amazing plants that can do that. And if you've got good drainage and you've got that height and width thing figured out, you're going to have a tree that will do really beautiful out in your landscape.
Yeah, I mean, so sort of, you know, speaking of like the rules and the exceptions and so forth, I mean, and looking at all that diversity, all the possibilities among the 1500 that you have on your website or whatever, I mean, I know there are some sort of general inferences we can draw about what conditions certain varieties will or won't tolerate, you know, based on their leaf color and so on. And I thought maybe we could talk about some of those, because that was another thing that I kind of knew as a longtime gardener, like, you know, gold leaf plants tend to have a particular relationship with where there's like too much sun at a certain point, you know, and it doesn't just, not just maples, but other things too. And understanding that, or, you know, what about the pink or white variegated ones, you know, so tell us a little bit about some of those sort of inferences you can draw about different leaf colors and so forth.
Yeah, there's so many different sun exposures in different areas. You know, we're in the mountains of Western North Carolina where our nursery's at. So we get by with more things in full sun than people say in Northern Florida or something like that. So there can definitely be different heat index tricks to that. Now, Japanese maples in general are going to work zones 5. And then we say on the East Coast up to zone 9, but zones are really rated by how cold. But it is a good generalization on the East Coast. And then there's a ton that can handle full sun. Now, ones that want to avoid sun in general are more pink and white Japanese maples. So the more pink and the more white you have in your leaf, typically those are going to need some more late day shade. Again, there's always exceptions to the rule. Yellow can kind of go into that category too, where in general, if it's a very bright yellow leaf, you want to give that some more, you know, 12 o'clock on protection or 2 o'clock on protection, depending on the area. So you're getting those leaves to look their best, even in the summer, protecting them to have the best fall color possible. And that's a good generalization. But again, you know, rules are always made to be broken with horticulture. There's always some that kind of go outside the box and do a little bit different.
Right. And you've been, as I said in the introduction, you guys, in collaboration in some cases with Mr. Buchholz, whose nursery you recently purchased, you know, you guys have been working on kind of stretching that a little bit too, like breeding, making some hybrids that can bring the color pink into slightly warmer zones, or the color gold into, haven't you? Isn't that sort of what people are working on, stretching the zones or the you know, the versatility of some of these plants?
That's for sure. With, for instance, Acer palmatum geisha gone wild that was developed at Buchholz Nursery, found as a sport on the cultivar geisha, it can handle more sun than most of your pink on red selections. An excellent tree in zone 8 can handle a little bit more sun than many of your other pink and red variegated types. And then we've been working here at Mr. Maple on developing hybrids with Acer oliveranum, which part of our heat seeker series that allow us to go even into much hotter zones. We've got some oliveranum hybrids that, you know, can handle full sun in Texas. And so it's one of those fun things where you start developing something and you start seeing that some of these species have quote unquote superpowers that allow you to push the zones on Japanese maples.
Right. Right. So working towards your goal of making it possible for everyone in the United States to have a Japanese maple in their yard.
for sure.
Yeah. What about the coral bark? Like there's that famous one, Sango Kaku, and there are others. What about the coral barks? Like, do they have particular, you know, or they're, yes, you know, places they do and don't like to be?
Yeah, we recommend this one typically to zone 6. We're 6B here in Western North Carolina. And most of your coral barks do have a little bit thinner cambium. So zone 5 can be stretching it, although I've seen some beautiful specimens in zone 5. Zone 5 can be a little too harsh in the extreme winters for the coral barks. They tend to work zone 6 and up, and just exceptional plants. They do tend to be very receptive to warmer climates. Dryness is really the key there. They don't want to be boggy or wet feet at all in any of the bark interest types. Soggy during the winter can be kind of one of their detriments. So they kind of like warmer spaces that are a little dry. They can actually handle a good bit of sandy soil as well and be very resistant to that. The main thing is not wet and too cold.
Now we have seen some of our Acer pseudosibuldianum hybrids we're working with starting to get some bark interest, like lighter yellow green colors. And we're hoping at one day that we can, you know, get some coral bark selections of those Acer pseudosibuldianums to push it down into zone 5 and maybe zone 4 with the Acer pseudosibuldianum species. So we're working not just on the heat tolerant side,
right,
but also trying to expand things on the cold tolerant side as well.
Well, the Acer pseudosibuldianum is was probably the first, quote, Japanese maple, even though I believe it's from Korea and China, maybe a little bit too, but and maybe elsewhere, but it's not technically Japanese in origin. But that was one of the first ones I ever grew in the ground. I was zone 5, 5B, and now I'm a 6 or something, but whatever. shifting world. But I had a nurseryman, a very choice, wonderful woody plant expert near me, and he said, this is the one other than, say, like, of the red uprights of Bloodgood, for instance. You know, this is one I feel really confident about is going to not get beat up in our climate, and, you know, because we have, like, ice storms and whatever, tough winters, or we used to. And so I had a big one in the ground for many, 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 many years, and it finally croaked, and who knows why, some soil-borne problem, I think. But that is an exceptionally hardy plant, and the fall foliage is beyond, I mean, just absolutely extravagant, fiery and wonderful. And I'm so excited to hear that it's becoming part of the sort of breeding formula for other, you know, for a new generation of maples. That's great, because it's a great plant. And yet I didn't know many people who knew it even.
Yeah, for sure. Talon Buchholz had started a whole program before we had actually taken over there. And before he knew we were even interested, he'd actually shared his whole series of seedlings with us. And so I think there's some groundbreaking ones there that have a lot of red to them as a pseudo Sieboldianum, some different color patterns. So things that are going to be hybrids with palmatum, likely to give them some more ornamental traits. But the goal is that once they are tested, that pseudo Sieboldianum trait will allow them to go into zone 4 and be even a little bit more climate pushing for some of the colder zones.
Yeah.
And just more all around cold hardy, so that when we do get those crazy polar vortexes, you're kind of a little more protected.
Speaking of those polar vortexes, the Acer Shirasanum hybrids that Talon Buchholz actually developed and introduced through Buchholz Nursery have actually proven to be more cold tolerant than many of the just straight palmatums during those polar vortexes. Many in zone 5, you know, talked about how their red Acer Shirasanum X palmatums from Buchholz have done really well. For instance, Shira Red, one that's similar, Red Dawn. There's a number of Acer Shirasanum hybrids, and people often said, you know, what's so great about these? And then when the polar vortexes hit, they said, guys, these are amazing.
This is what's good about them. Yeah. And in because of the worry about the hardiness and so forth, and it isn't even the hardiness of, like, it was more the damage that would be done by one of our northern winters, I think, you know. It wouldn't necessarily kill the thing, but it beat it up so bad, you know, in some of the cases. So I, earlier on, when I started buying them years ago, and maybe I only have 10 or 12 or something, but they're in pots. And, you know, I wheel them on a handcart into the garage every winter. It's unheated, but it keeps them out of that sort of ice and wind mess. But now, of course, I understand that they probably would be fine outside, you know, but again, nobody really knew way back when, you know, decades ago up here, it wasn't really the common thing. Bloodgood was around and a couple of weeping cutleaf type, lace leaf types, but, you know, you really didn't see much diversity of choices. And I bought mine, you know, mail order or something, and just put them in a pot and tried them. So, yeah. So, and that's another way to grow them, right? And I think they're gorgeous as pot specimens, and they can live a really long time that way. Now, I shouldn't then take it out of the pot and expect it to do well planted in the ground right after it's been bonsai, so to speak, for so long.
A lot of times they'll take off. So a lot of times you want to check them about, what we recommend is checking a tree about every 5 years, making sure that the roots haven't grown into the drain holes.
Yeah.
Making sure it's still got good drainage. I mean, I've seen some in some instances where the trees used up most of the nutrients. And so it, you know, can reduce the root ball a little bit during the right time of the year, put it back in the same size pot or a bigger pot, but you'll need to add some nutrients to it. A lot of times, a lot of those trees, though, they've been in a big container for quite a while. Once they do get in the ground, they tend to leap. And people will say, well, how long can a tree be in a container? And sometimes I'll show them, you know, some 20-year-old specimens here at the nursery, and they've never been in the ground. So they can be in a container for quite a while, as long as you've got good drainage. I tend to protect in zone 5 when they're outside. I think sometimes, especially where I'm at, people are overly protective, and they're better off leaving their tree outside in a zone 6 for most winters, even in a container. But my experience most of the time is they tend to leap when they finally do get some room to spread out their roots in the ground.
When you set them free.
Yeah, like, thank goodness we get the soil running.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have some that are like close to 20 years old, but they've been moved up and, you know, I've stepped them up over, you know, over their first few years. They got stepped up in pots, bigger, biggest giant pots, but I don't have any pots that are any bigger anymore to put them in. But so any other like tips for, one of you mentioned like good drainage, and that's a universal sort of rule with Japanese maples is no swampy site. And that's one of the reasons I think you told me when we did the Times article that growing them in pots really does work because it gives them that sharp drainage. Mm-hmm. So any other sort of, feeding, no feeding, watering things, when to prune, anything else that we need to know to be a good parent to one of these guys?
Yeah, with Japanese maples, they're really easy to take care of. They're one of the easiest plants. And often those plants that people put on the landscape that's got good drainage is going to thrive and do well. The main thing is whenever you're planting these, don't bury the tree. Whenever you have the tree, you know, you get a tree and from a container or anywhere and you go to plant it in the landscape, plant it level or slightly raised. If you raise it up a little bit, you're going to ensure you've got good drainage. And you're also not going to smother that root ball. Often people will make that volcano of death and mulch around too much around the base, which can smother the plant. And you really start to notice that during the summer months.
Now, fertilizing can be an interesting thing. J.D. Vertrees, who wrote the first book on Japanese maples, he kind of tried to dummy proof it. He said, everybody don't fertilize your Japanese maples. There's no need to. And I guess he was just trying to make sure that people didn't overdo it. I think really the key is moderation with fertilizers. Now, we recommend low nitrogen. You don't want to over push your tree. And we find that the relationship between fertilizer and winterization, especially in your area, is a big relationship. So you don't want to be over pushing the tree, especially late. A lot of our bag release mixes we use, you know, as gardeners, we'll have 180-day release on some of those granulated fertilizers. And so if we're putting that out in August, we could be keeping our tree way too active for that late, that cold snap that could be coming kind of early actually in October. So that late fall cold snap can be kind of detrimental, especially to new growth. So we don't want to be over pushing our Japanese maples. When they're growing at a more moderate pace, they have a better cell wall and they hold up better against, you know, the elements. They're a happier, healthier plant because they're not over pushed. So we recommend low nitrogen. And what we do here at our nursery, it really works well for North Carolina and it would work well for most of the East Coast for sure, is cutting off all of our fertilizer around May. So if we're putting out any more fertilizer, we tend to stop in May. You know, when June hits, we're like, no moss, that's enough. No more fertilizers go out this season.
Right.
Cut it off completely. And that way we know the tree's shutting down in time for winter. If we get one of those early cold spells, we're not setting it up for failure.
Because it can not only screw up the fall color show, it can also mean that soft, tender growth is being pushed so late that's then going to get blasted by winter,
exactly.
Right? So that's exactly. A double whammy, you know, one is just visual, the other is actually could be damaging.
But that's a great point too. You'll have better fall colors if the tree is naturally shutting down.
Right.
So to your point, that's the ideal. Some people say, well, I didn't have that great a fall color on my tree. And I was like, well, when were you fertilizing? I don't think I fertilized them, but I did fertilize, you know, the other plants I had around my Japanese maples in August. You're right. And then they'll think, you know, I did give them a lot of liquids and I did give them a lot of fertilizers late because I was fertilizing the other plants in that same bed. And
right.
So you got to be conscious of that because sometimes you'll give them a little bit of a too much of a push at the wrong time of the year.
Yeah. So like in the last 3 minutes or so, I'm just curious. I mean, you have 1500 or so in your collection already. I think when we've talked before, you've said there's probably, you know, 2,500 or something different Japanese maples out there in the world, maybe more, who knows. And is there like a holy grail? Is there something that you and other experts like yourselves who are completely immersed in the world of Japanese maples, is there something else that you're all looking for or hoping to figure? Is it this extended hardiness thing? Is that what it is? Or is there something else?
There's definitely a bit of that. We're always, Tim used the term superpower. So when we're going through and looking for trees, what we try to do whenever we name something is improve upon it. We, you know, there's a million orchids, there's a million hostas, there's a million maples, and we don't just need something new for the sake of new. And a lot of times some of our favorite trees have been around since the 1700s. So they're tried and true and tested. Now, what we do at our nursery is if we're going to name something, we try to name the five closest things to it and say, is it better or worse than those things and how? And so we have to be able to say it's better than Kiyohime for these reasons. And then we want to watch it for 7 years, put it in some different places, send one to Oregon, send one to New Jersey, send one to Florida, and kind of see what's going on with that tree over, you know, a longer period of time grafted, so we can kind of evaluate it to make sure we're not just reintroducing, you know, we don't want to reinvent the wheel here. We've already got things that are great, and we don't really need another one unless it has a good reason to be. So we like that, but we also like to do cutting edge stuff here at our nursery. We're always looking for fun and interesting things, and we try to break the mold for what can be done. So we like those rule breakers. So we like things that are in other species that are interesting. Like the Olivierinum Tim was talking about, one of the holy grails for a while for nurserymen has been a really nice redder form of Macaw Yetsibusa. We've recently came out with one that's been our best. We've been through about 2000 or so red Macaw seedlings since around 2008. We started evaluating them and we just kind of grade them. So we'll go through and grade and go best one gets planted, and then the rest just gets sold off as seedlings sometimes. So they can be great plants, but they don't deserve cultivar status. Mm. And we've recently kind of released one called Red Panda that's been a big hit for us. That's kind of been a holy grail for a lot of people. I think the name's fun too. I was looking at a Red Panda with my kids at one of our local nature centers here. They have a native animals exhibit, and they had this one animal that's not the Red Panda. And so my kids absolutely love the Red Panda here locally. And said, you know, that'd be a perfect name for that red Macaw Yetsibusa we have. So people have been really crazy about that one. The hype's been really high on that one. It's kind of been one of our most recent holy grail types to release.
Cool. Well, Matt and Tim, I'm so glad to speak to you as always. And it was fun doing the time story together. And I wish you the best with all the transition with Buchholz Nursery and all the other things you're doing. I saw you on Instagram planting daylilies the other day. So I'm assuming MrDaylily.com is next because you're so crazy. but thank you so much for making time today.
Tim and I actually bought my first car, and he bought the first family computer working at Daylily Farm. So I guess we've always been crazy hoarders of plants. So we've always had the bug for something. I'm just so honored you had us on. Thank you so much. And for the article and just everything. We're just humbled and honored whenever anybody wants to talk to us about plants, and we're still shocked every time they do.
Well, good. And I'll talk to both of you again soon.
Thank you, Margaret.
Tim. Thank you. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Now don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third generation bulb company offering top size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.